Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We start with our news today. Rice plantings in California are at their lowest level since 1992. The California Farm Bureau says farmers are expecting to harvest 405,000 acres this year, which is down 21% from 2020. Medium grain rice remains the dominant variety grown in California, with much of that coming from the Sacramento Valley. All told, California accounts for nearly 70% of the U.S. medium and short grain rice supply. House Ag Committee Chair David Scott and fellow Democrats sent a letter to House and Senate leadership asking them to preserve the ag spending provisions in the Build Back Better Act. They point out that the provisions included in the agriculture portion of that Build Back Better Act will make transformative investments that will benefit agricultural producers and rural communities for years in areas of agricultural research, rural development, renewable energy, biofuels, conservation, and forestry. How can farmers adopt more practices to produce more climate-friendly commodities? Tom Vilsack has a plan. Gary Crawford has the story.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is working to get more farmers to buy into more climate-smart farming practices and is doing some research on measuring the benefits of those practices.
But the reality is we've got to do more.
And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told an audience at Colorado State University the other day more is exactly what's going to be done.
Today, we're beginning a process to develop what we refer to as a Climate Smart Partnership Initiative.
A long-term comprehensive project that Vilsack says
will help finance the production of climate smart commodities through a series of large-scale pilots and demonstration projects funded from the USDA. And as importantly, to finance the steps necessary to properly measure and validate the environmental response and result from these practices.
Which, of course, would be key to getting farmers to test or adopt certain practices and key to convincing buyers of crops and livestock products that they are indeed being produced in a more sustainable, environmentally friendly way. And so Vilsack gave a few examples of how this new initiative might work.
USDA might support a group of dairy farmers seeking to reduce emissions from manure and increasing carbon sequestration on cropland as part of their milk production system. We could fund corn and soybean producers interested in producing a climate-smart commodity for their retail buyer. We could resource a biofuel company in its development of a low-carbon biofuel, or help organic producers quantify the climate result of their organic practices.
But Vilsack says this is not a program for an individual farmer to sign up for, not like a usual conservation program. This is going to be on a larger scale.
This initiative will provide support to farm groups, businesses, states, tribes, and other nonprofit organizations that are working with multiple producers and landowners to apply climate-smart agricultural practices on farms, ranches, and forested areas.
That's what the initiative will be. Here's what the secretary says it's not going to be.
I want to be clear, this initiative is not a carbon bank or a carbon market. It's not even a conservation program. This is first and foremost a commodity program, one that seeks to empower farmers, ranchers, and foresters to produce climate-smart commodities, meeting domestic and global consumer demand.
And so as a commodity program, Vilsack says he can tap into the USDA's Commodity Credit Corporation funds to operate the program, which will help us find out if a particular climate smart practice will actually work operationally, financially for farmers, because Vilsack says it's got to work for farmers,
or it won't work for our climate.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And the Agriculture Secretary says the USDA is working on a proposal for a waiver system for hog plants forced by a federal court to slow down their processing lines. Waivers that would allow plants to speed up processing lines again could renew concerns about worker safety, but boost profits for pork companies and farmers. Vilsack did not specify what those waivers would do or how they would get implemented. A federal judge ruled earlier this year against the Trump administration rule that allowed pork plants to run slaughter lines without speed limits as long as they prevented contamination and minimized bacteria. Industry analysts were perhaps surprised by the latest USDA forecast regarding wheat, soybean, and corn stocks, Rud Bain reports.
In looking at USDA's latest quarterly grain stocks estimates, Agriculture Department Chief Economist Seth Meyer says note should be taken of the following.
There's an ability now at this point in the year that the marketing year has just ended for them to make some further adjustments on crop size for corn and soybeans. And for wheat stocks now, they're a quarter in. So this more represents disappearance over that first quarter.
So revisions include 2020 corn production down 71 million bushels and U.S. soybean production up almost 81 million bushels from the previous estimate going into the look at grain stocks. Wheat stock disappearance from the previous quarter, however, was up 2%. Even with those revisions, Myers says perhaps USDA's projections for quarterly stocks were in some cases surprising compared to what industry analysts were expecting. Take, for example, the latest wheat stocks forecast, down 18% from 1 year ago.
The surprise on wheat crop would be on the lower end of trade expectations for wheat. So that might be one of the few here, which is on the bullish side for grains as we talk about what stocks are.
Perhaps more surprising was what USDA estimated soybean ending stocks would be versus what the trade analysts were forecasting. Although bean stocks were adjusted down 51% from the previous year in the Agriculture Department's quarterly stock forecast, industry forecasters had those projections significantly lower than that.
Really taking what was getting to be a quite tight implied carryout number and giving it a bigger cushion.
Corn ending stocks, meanwhile, were lowered by 36% year over year. Yet,
for corn, not so much different than the trade expected.
As the chief economist explains,
there is an expectation that despite NAS decreasing corn production a little bit for the 2020 production and increasing soybean production for 2020, both of them have a larger than anticipated increase in carryout stocks for that year.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Biden administration's requirement that all federal employees, including employees of the Farm Service Agency, be vaccinated against COVID-19 will not cause FSA offices to close or farmers to receive a less than usual level of service. The Hagstrom Report says Ag Secretary Vilsack made that statement last week during a House committee hearing. Representative Vicki Hartzler of Missouri mentioned to the secretary that she's afraid the reluctance of some employees to get the vaccine might cause FSA offices to close or, worse, have to provide a lower level of service than farmers have come to expect. That's our news for today. Taylor Chalstrom is up next. We will be right back.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today, we're talking with Timmy Jacobs, USDA Risk Management Specialist, about biosolarization and cover crop impact on weeds and soil-borne pathogens. Welcome to the podcast, Timmy.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here today. Timmy, I want to do a little clarification before we jump into the topic here. You know, soil solarization involves increasing soil temperatures to lethal levels for pathogens, pests, and weeds with polyethylene tarps, while biosolarization adds an organic amendment aspect to that process. Can you explain what biosolarization really is and how it can enhance normal solarization efficacy in soils?
Sure, absolutely. So you actually said it pretty much perfectly. Biosolarization is pretty much just you incorporate an organic amendment into the soil and then you solarize it. And that's biosolarization. It can really be done with, you know, any organic amendment. Common organic amendments are, you know, processing byproducts such as tomato pomace, grape pomace, compost, manure and fertilizers and, cover crop residues, green manure. And for biosolarization uses, the general kind of goal with biosolarization is that you want to, in areas where solarization is already an effective treatment, the goal is that by incorporating that organic amendment, you can shorten the time you need for solarization. So instead, normal solarization treatment, you want your tarp on for 4 to 6 weeks. For biosolarization, you can hopefully, solarize in as little as 1 to 2 weeks. I think there was a recent study published where I saw they had, they biosolarized for about 2 weeks and then they solarized for 4 weeks roughly. That might even been a little longer, and they got similar results. So that's kind of one purpose of biosolarization in terms of increasing the efficacy of solarization. And the other is in marginal areas where, you might not get ideal conditions for solarization, say along the central coast of California, temperatures are generally cooler and you have frequent, foggy mornings, reducing the solar radiation you get. The goal is that by incorporating organic amendment, you can hopefully use some of those extra benefits that biosolarization can offer, and that can increase the efficacy of solarization, allowing it to be used in areas where it might not be super effective. And that was certainly the reasoning behind why we tried out our experiment in the San Luis Obispo region, which is an area, we have frequent fog in the mornings. Temperatures rarely get above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's quite cool.
That was an interesting aspect of it, that it's like a large reasoning behind your guys' use of it was purely based on the weather aspects of that region. Is there kind of a threshold of weather where it just simply does not work? It's just not effective?
Sure, yeah. We did our research on strawberries, and doing so, I reviewed kind of, over the past couple of decades, there's been a lot of research into alternatives to methyl bromide for soil fumigation. So they've done, studies with solarization in a lot of these, strawberry production regions along the central coast. And for example, in the Salinas and Watsonville area, researchers found no significant effects in solarization over a control. So essentially, solarization really didn't do anything or really do much to control weeds and pathogens. Whereas, in more Southern California production regions, they saw that it did have an effect, but perhaps not as much as, a fumigant, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, my next question for you here, Timmy, you referenced this research project that you were a part of in San Luis Obispo, along with Cal Poly Professor Ashraf Tubale. So you were part of that project that examined the effects of solarization and biosolarization on some weeds and pathogens. Can you tell me a little bit about what were some of the key takeaways from your guys' research project there?
Key takeaways is, I would say the first takeaway is that in between all of our student grass treatments, there really was no significant difference between all of them and kind of most of the aspects we studied. There was a brief, kind of a minor effect on weed populations, and that student grass mulch tended to suppress weeds a little better than our other student grass treatments. But I can get into that a little more later when we talk about cover crop residues. What we found was that solarization was effective in reducing weed populations, pathogen populations, disease severity, and increasing yields in strawberries. So just kind of do the highlights. It reduced weed biomass and weed density for up to 3.5 months after removing the tarp. So we saw essentially better weed control in our solarized plots and our non-solarized plots till about middle to late December. Then after that, for the rest of the growing season, it was about similar weed populations between the two treatments. We saw about an 80% reduction in Verticillium dahlia populations in our solarized plots. And throughout the entire growing period, we saw a significant reduction in Verticillium dahlia or Verticillium wilt compared to non-solarized plots. And in terms of, overall strawberry health and disease severity, in our non-solarized plots, we found that they were experiencing quite severe disease in April, to the point where in May, they were no longer producing viable fruit in many of our non-solarized plots. Whereas in our solarized plots, we saw no disease really until June. And in June, we started seeing some disease. We also, we tested the strawberries for the disease that they died from. And we tried to isolate the disease, which killed the strawberries. Mm-hmm. And what we found was that in our non-solarized plots was that verticillium wilt was the primary pathogen which killed our strawberries. Whereas in solarized plots, charcoal rot or Macrophemina phaeazolina was the primary pathogen which killed our strawberries. We didn't measure charcoal rot populations in our soil, so we don't really have a comparison before or after. But given that we did see some death of our strawberries from this pathogen, we kind of indicated, along with kind of looking at laboratory results, that we didn't achieve great control of this pathogen. In terms of our temper, first I'll talk about yields. Our solarized plots did have triple the yields of our non-solarized plots. So that was kind of a really cool thing to see is just how much healthier and much more yield those plants produce than in our non-solarized plots. And then in terms of the temperatures we got about our average daily temperature at about 2 inches in the soil was 43 degrees Celsius, which I think is around 106 or 108 degrees Fahrenheit. I kind of know the rough approximations from Celsius to Fahrenheit, but not exact. And then and this is about 10 to 15 degrees Celsius on average higher than our non-solarized plots. So that was kind of the temperature difference between the plots. And the highest temperature we achieved was 52 or 53 degrees Celsius in one of our solarized plots at a 2-inch depth. And kind of the goal for solarization, just for reference, is you want to get, I would recommend, you really want to see temperatures 45 to 50 degrees Celsius or higher every day for a couple hours for a 4-week period, if you really want to get really good control of stuff. We didn't quite achieve that in our study. As we mentioned before, San Luis Obispo is kind of it could be considered a marginal area for solarization given the frequent fog and lower temperatures. And our study kind of showed that, we can get good control of some weeds and pathogens, but given the experience we saw with Macrophemina phaeazolina, we weren't able to control everything to kind of conditions that, a fumigant will have really ideal conditions, I guess. So we still had some pathogens and weeds in this soil.
All right, we're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, we're back talking with Timmy Jacobs, USDA Risk Management Specialist, about biosolarization and cover crop impact on weeds and soil-borne pathogens. Timmy, I want to get into the cover crop aspect a little bit more here. When using a cover crop as an organic amendment to pair with solarization, what seemed to be the most effective use strategy that you guys found? Could other organic amendments potentially perform better under the same conditions that you guys saw?
Yeah, so just kind of in our experiment, In terms of the kind of the cover crop efficacy, you know, ultimately we saw no difference. We did see a slight reduction in disease severity in our sudden grass mulch treatments, as well as a reduction in wheat populations in our sudden grass mulch in our sudden grass mulch treatment. However, you know, as I mentioned before, we did have the issues with the establishing strawberries in these pots, given to the fact that we're planting to a living cover crop. And we also had, you know, potentially variable pathogen populations within our soil, which could have just led to healthier plants in the sudden grass mulch pots, just due to that pathogen variability, as opposed to any real effect the sudden grass mulch was having. But with that being said, because we did not see any significant differences in between yield between the three treatments, actually what I would recommend to growers is just solarize without, you know, the cover crop, simply because, you know, to grow a cover crop before solarization, that was another 2 month period that your field's out of production. I mean, you know, and that's the most challenging thing for most growers to implement solarization, is just finding that month period during the summer to find time to solarize your crop. And then, you know, adding on actually, you know, an entire period where you're growing a cover crop, you know, applying fertilizer and applying irrigation to that cover crop without seeing, you know, a significant increase in that yield over, you know, a treatment which didn't have a cover crop, at least in terms of the solarized plots, I would recommend that they just solarize without a cover crop, just for time's sake, you know, and to make it easier to fit into their rotation. In terms of other organic amendments potentially performing better under the same conditions, I know that there's you know, research into processing bride products such as tomato pumice and grape pumice, which have shown some promising results. Biosolarized agent experiments in Spain where they used chicken manure showed promising results. However, I know I think there might be different regulations regarding the application of manure on, you know, fields in regards to food safety in America and Spain. So that's something I would look into before applying manure to your field. I know there is definitely a harvest interval there where you have to, you know, you can only have manure. You have to have a certain number of time between when you harvest and when you apply manure. So that's something to take into consideration. But I would say, you know, certainly other organic amendments, I think, you know, could work well. And certainly with a lot of other organic amendments, like a compost or a manure or, you know, something like rice bran or molasses, you also do not have that 2 month period of growing, which the cover crop has. And certainly, you know, if you can source a compost or, you know, if you live near, you know, perhaps like a processing tomato facility, you can get tomato pumice really easily. If you can source these materials and incorporate them into your soil without, you know, that 2 month period of growing a cover crop, you know, that, you know, you could certainly, it would be, I think, easier to try out than perhaps growing a cover crop and solarizing. Especially since, you know, certainly cover crops have a lot of benefits too. And, you know, as well as compost and all these soil treatments. And I think that really the biggest factor is just the time it takes for the cover crop to grow.
All right. Well, good points to me. I really, really appreciate some of those tips there. I do want to get your final thoughts though on solarization and biosolarization in general, just the kind of your opinion on implementation of it. You know, do you have any other tips for growers out there that might want to implement it? Do you always recommend it in certain areas, that type of thing?
Yeah, a couple of just kind of, you know, minor things. Soil plastic contact is really important. So any kind of air gap that there is between the plastic and the soil will lead to lower temperatures. This is kind of what we saw with our mulch treatment and why it had lower temperatures by, you know, about 2 to 3 degrees Celsius, which did lead to, you know, lower effectiveness controlling weeds. And also kind of, we also noticed that in some of the beds we had, you know, there's, you know, always little divots or, you know, stuff in the beds you create sometimes. And some of these divots, we saw actually saw purslane germinating in our beds. This, you know, purslane can germinate at temperatures as high as 45 degrees Celsius, 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Kind of a bit of an aside as well, but, you know, we didn't necessarily achieve temperatures above this in our experiment. And that's kind of something else I want, you know, that's important to consider too, is that different weeds and different pathogens do have different tolerances for solarization. Also, hard-seeded weeds. So these are weeds with a thick seed coat. Examples are a lot of seeds in the legume family, such as bur clover or sweet clover are weeds which have a hard seed coat. Or the Malvaceae family, little mallow and velvet leaf have a thick weed coat. Also red stem fillery. And essentially what I mean by hard seed coat, is that these seeds have a thick seed coat, which they kind of use to induce dormancy so that, you know, they can live a very long time in the soil. This thick seed coat prevents, you know, them from imbibing the water in most cases, which is what allows them to, you know, live for a very long time. You know, some of these seeds can live in the soil, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. And so, but anyways, that inability to imbibe water, as I mentioned before, a dry heat is far less effective at killing weeds than a wet heat. That inability to imbibe water makes them more challenging to kill than, you know, other weed seeds which don't have as thick of a seed coat and do imbibe that water. And so, for example, for little mallow, we found that, you know, it was affected by temperatures at 45 degrees Celsius, but it took 600 hours of constant exposure to 45 degrees Celsius to really reduce germination rates to close to zero. And so, you know, and certainly field conditions are a little different with hard-seeded weed species because you'll have differences in, you know, as kind of time goes on, the seed coat does start to get cracked and it breaks down and they do imbibe water. So, you know, things could be a little different in field condition, but it's important to note that, you know, these hard-seeded weeds can be tougher to control with solarization. And also perennial weeds are tougher to control with solarization. Perennial weed seeds, perennial structures such as tubers, rhizomes, stolons can be tougher to control. And, you know, we also saw with pathogens, I know a little more about weeds and pathogens, but we saw differences in our study, you know, in terms of, you know, tropical rot wasn't particularly well controlled, whereas verticillium wilt was. And so, you know, as with any treatment technique, it's important to consider what weeds and pathogens you have in your field and if solarization may or not be effective against them. In kind of regards to biosolarization, you know, biosolarization is, you know, still a bit experimental in terms of there aren't really good guidelines, I would say, in terms of what amendments to apply and how they will react and, you know, how to implement it into a cropping system. And certainly biosolarization could, you know, increase the effect against some of these troublesome weeds or pathogens, even in, you know, marginal areas, you could get potentially, you know, get good control of these things. You know, I think it, you know, remains to be seen a little bit. I know, for example, anaerobic soil disinfestation is able to effectively control charcoal rot. And so, you know, that's, you know, anaerobic soil disinfestation, I would say, is a cousin, if not a sibling, of biosolarization. And there's certainly, I think, room for biosolarization to improve the efficacy of solarization. And yeah, I think they're both very promising techniques. And I think, you know, the solarization certainly, particularly for organic growers where, you know, chemical fumigation options are not available, they are an effective technique where under the right conditions, you know, you can get really good control, even comparable to that of chemical fumigation in some areas. You know, particularly in areas such as the Central Valley or desert where you do get really high temperatures in the summer, you know, it can be really effective in those areas. And biosolarization is really a potential way to, you know, spread that efficacy to areas with more marginal conditions and, you know, reduce the time potentially, allowing growers to more easier fit it sit solarization for their rotations.
Hopefully more experiments like the one you and Ashraf did in San Luis Obispo can take place in the future, and maybe it can become a viable method for some of those more marginal areas of the state. So thank you for joining me today, Timmy.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate getting the chance to talk about this really cool topic.
Yeah, and a really cool topic it is. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
AgroMiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgroMiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgroMiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Does your crop have iron chlorosis? AgroPlanté has a solution for you. Traditionally, chelated iron has limitations that AgroPlanté's Iron Force does not. Iron Force, with its EDDHA chelation technology, can turn your plant's iron chlorosis from yellow to green in as little as 15 days, despite unbalanced soil pH and calcareous soils. From organic certified to conventional micronutrients, AgroPlanté has the product for you. Call 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplanté.com. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. Several rural healthcare facilities have been able to expand facilities thanks in part to USDA Rural Development grants and loans. In turn, that has led to expanded and much-needed services and staff in the communities they serve. Rod Bain looks at examples of rural development funding and the role it has played in increasing rural healthcare offerings in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Rural healthcare. It has been a challenge for these entities in recent years to meet needed services to their clients, let alone in some cases, to keep doors open. Yet there are stories of facilities that are offering expanded services in new, remodeled, or renovated buildings. Many of those involve support via USDA Rural Development grants and loans.
The USDA is definitely something, especially from a nonprofit perspective, to really look at to get financing.
With working with USDA, they really made a big difference for us.
We have all of the pieces that USDA was wanting to put money toward, and I think we hit them all.
It's been a remarkable journey with the USDA.
I'm Rod Bain, and I'm joined by rural healthcare administrators who explain how RD funding is making a difference in the communities they serve in this edition of Agriculture USA. What are some examples of the Agriculture Department's Rural Development Mission Area providing support to rural healthcare facilities so they can offer needed programs and services to their communities and regions? Start with Family Health Care of Northwestern Ohio, which began as a federally qualified health center lookalike, providing medical service but not dental due to its initial designation.
We knew if there was ever an opportunity to apply to be a fully funded health center, that would be our first priority.
Executive Director Jennifer Smith says once full FQHC status was achieved a decade later, Family Health Care applied for and received a USDA Rural Development Community Facility city's load.
We were able to purchase the building, renovate the building with the expansion that allowed us in that same year to not only now start offering dental services, we started providing behavioral health services as well.
Meanwhile, the rural Texas-based Cactus Health Services was outgrowing its leased facility in a non-commercial area. CEO Luis Villarreal says that led to inquiry about USDA rural development healthcare-related grants and loans.
It took us a year and a half to get to where we needed to be when we came in here at the beginning of 2019. It was such a joy to walk into this clinic.
A constructed modular building with expanded exam, lab, mental health, and intake offices among its improvements. Villarreal, however, notes another impact, expanded staff and staff training.
How can we make you more successful? And if you do that and you treat the staff right, and that's going to be a plus for the patients because that's the way you want the patients to be treated.
Another RD community facilities loan played a part in expansion of services for a one-of-its-kind specialty children's hospital located in rural southeastern New York State.
The center is the largest pediatric program of its kind in New York to deal with children with complex conditions, medical conditions, autism, and other disabilities.
Center of Discovery CEO Patrick Dollard says through this loan, the regional facility will offer services soon on a statewide level.
Caring for kids who are on their way to leaving the home and the school district because of their complexity, and we hope to be able to get them into a short-term assessment opportunity inside the specialty hospital. It'll be one of the few in the country that's attempting to do that.
Providing education and care during a child's stay and offering the community and region economic opportunity by way of construction and jobs. In the state of Maine, a recovery house in the northernmost county, the only one in that county at that, needed renovation. As Bill Flagg of the Center for the Advancement of Rural Living explains.
At the time we were looking to refinance the men's recovery house here, we were also looking to open a women's recovery house.
After looking at traditional financing avenues, the center successfully applied for both a direct community facilities loan and communities facilities grant. That funding enabled not only the renovations at the men's halfway house, but purchase and renovation of a new women's halfway house as well.
One of the things that's advantageous about the USDA program is that it's a 40-year mortgage. That is not normally the thing when you go to conventional financing. And in addition to that, the interest rate on the loan was half of what we were paying originally.
Among Rural Development's grant and loan programs in its portfolio is the newly announced Emergency Rural Health Care Grants. RD is accepting funding applications for that program through October 12th. More information is available through state rural development offices and online at www.rd.usda.gov. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.